The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, everything you've ever wanted to know about drugs.
You know, if we say we're going to stop kids taking ecstasy because it's harmful, we should at least have a proper measure of relative harms in comparison to what other things kids do.
We speak to Professor David Nutt on the science of recreational drugs. We'll explore why their potential benefits are often overlooked in a rush to focus on their potential harms. We discussed at length with Professor Nutt why he felt compelled to step in to create an evidence-based measure on the true harms of drug use. Professor David Nutt is a psychiatrist and a neuropsychopharmacologist who's dedicated his long and distinguished career to an understanding of drugs that affect the brain and how they might be used for the clinical benefit of his patients. Another part of his career has been his role as an advisor to government, and it's here where he stepped into controversy. After a number of years as the government's chief scientific advisor on drugs, he was sacked from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs in 2009 by the then Home Secretary, Alan Johnson.
3 days before he sacked me, we'd had a meeting and we discussed all the complexities about new legal highs. You know, we'd had a very rational, sensible discussion. I thought we were on the same wavelength.
We discussed the perils of a scientist who dabbles in campaigning and his subsequent creation of an independent, evidence-based drugs advisory body. Professor Nutt has recently distilled his many years of drug-related wisdom into a new book, Drugs Without the Hot Air, Minimizing the Harms of Legal and Illegal Drugs. When he came into the studio, he talked to me about the history of recreational drugs, their harms, and also the problems scientists are having in trying to do experiments or research with these much maligned chemical compounds. David, thank you so much for coming in. Can we start with some of the neuroscience, the chemistry of drugs and the effects on the brain? What is going on in the brain of a normal person from the moment they wake up? Tell us about the chemical cascades and all of that.
The brain is a very complex collection of neurons which communicate through chemicals, and there may be 80 to 100 different chemicals that make the brain work properly. And some of the chemicals wake us up. So as we're waking up, chemicals like noradrenaline, histamine, orexins are released to cause arousal, to get you up and going. And then during the course of the day, when you eat, different chemicals are released to determine what foods you eat and how much you eat. And then when you get towards the end of the day, some chemicals are switched off and others like GABA are turned on to put you to sleep. Then superimposed on all that are interesting things that happen. So if you suddenly get stressed, if you nearly get run over by a bus, then there's a big surge of noradrenaline and that'll cause anxiety and make you run out the way of the bus. But then there'll be a compensatory release of serotonin to try to calm you down and help deal with those anxieties.
So these chemicals are not only affecting your behavior, they're affecting your mood, they make you hungry, they make you happy, sad, all these things. So then you immediately get into the situation where the drugs that people might take to affect them purposefully in certain ways, that's where they come in. So this is how they're affecting your mood and your happiness. So the drugs that we are going to talk about in this program are things like cannabis, ecstasy, opioids, LSD, amphetamines. How do these sorts of things fit into that system you just described? What are they doing?
So it turns out that pretty much any drug substance that people take works on one of the neurotransmitter systems in the brain. And if we look through evolution, it's quite fascinating. There's been this interaction between animals and plants since the beginning of time. It goes back to fungi. Fungi started eating bacteria. Bacteria started producing substances to stop fungi eating them. And those actually are antibiotics, and we use them today as antibiotics. And then as plants got more sophisticated and animals got more sophisticated, plants started making substances like caffeine, like nicotine, like opium, like cannabis. They put them into the plants in order largely to deter insects from eating them. And what's paradoxical and fascinating is that all of these chemicals work on neurotransmitter systems, which are present in animal brain and therefore present in our brain. So effectively, all the drugs we use come from plants and work on as mimics of the chemicals in our brain.
So in the insects, they were just these plants evolved these chemicals to sort of stop them from being eaten. Yes. For us, they happen to make us, well, whatever, happy, yeah, sad, slightly right, delusional, whatever else.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that quite fascinating, isn't it? So the evolution of the plant has coincidentally produced substances which are, well, some substances which are particularly appealing to humans. Now, of course, plants have also evolved lots of other chemicals to deter insects, which we don't like, and we therefore don't use them. But just in that, there's a small fraction of the plant protective chemicals which happen to interact with chemical systems in our brain. And those systems, when they work on systems which give us pleasure or relax us or excite us, then we use them.
Now, before we knew about brain chemicals, before we knew even that these plants had chemicals, people have been using plants, chewing on coca leaves or, you know, smoking opium. What would give us a bit of a potted history of our attempts to affect our mood and gain pleasure from plants?
Yes, well, so, I mean, humans obviously, you know, rely on plants to survive. And from the early, pretty much earliest recorded history, people have known that some plants produce beneficial effects. And the oldest one is probably cannabis, where we know for about 4,000 years people have used cannabis, usually eating it, as a way of reducing pain and suffering. And opium is not far behind, and people have, again, initially eaten it and subsequently smoked it as a way of reducing pain and inducing sleep. And alcohol, about 3,000 years ago, people realized that plants were fermented to alcohol, and they could use the fermented plants, and then wine growing about 3,000 years ago. So that's the history of these of the beginnings of pharmacology, psychopharmacology.
And so over time, these things have been refined, used in medicine, and then at some stage, a lot of these things started to get onto the social policy agenda. They started to get banned for whatever reason. We'll come to some of the policy debates now a bit later. But tell us about some of the drugs' medical uses over time. So things like opium, things like the cannabinoids, and so on.
Yes. There are two aspects to this. The first is that, by and large, when plants products are used from the plant, directly from the plant, they tend not to cause major problems in terms of dependence. So, and what we've seen over the last 300-400 years is the extraction of the active ingredient from many substances, so cocaine from coca leaves. And the active ingredient then is purified, and the pure compounds often are more problematic. In fact, generally are more problematic than the original compounds. So, for instance, coca leaves, there's no evidence that chewing coca leaf leads to any dependence. It's a very useful way of dealing with altitude sickness or having to work at high altitude in the Andes. But it was only when cocaine was extracted as a pure form that people had problems with it. And another example is heroin. Heroin is considerably more dangerous, particularly when injected, than opium when smoked. So producing the pure compound, which is part of the sort of the Western scientific approach to medicine, has been useful in getting more powerful drugs, but it's also had the downside of producing drugs which are more addictive.
I mean, this is exactly the same process as you would if you found some sort of cure for something in the rainforest. You would extract the active ingredient, put it into a pill, and then give it to people, do it clinical trials with it, etc.
Yes.
This is the same process.
It is the same process. It's the same scientific pharmaceutical process of trying to identify active ingredients and then essentially optimize their purity, and of course, in the case of opiates, we've gone even further. We've now made, based on the molecular structure of morphine, we've made drugs which are super, you know, even more potent than morphine, even more potent than natural substance.
So, sticking with the medical sort of benefits, for things like morphine and other opioids, they're used, you know, now and have been for a long time in relieving pain. It might be a surprise to people that something like LSD was initially invented around a sort of medical context. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so LSD came out of a project to effectively deal with the aging brain. The person who discovered it was working on substances to improve blood flow to the brain. And many substances which we currently use today for migraines, they come from the chemical called ergot. And ergot comes out of fungi which grow on wheat and rye. So you can extract the ergot substances for migraine from those. And Albert Hofmann was just doing the usual chemical modification of ergot to try to find something that was better than the traditional ergots. And he found something which was different. The LSD wasn't like a typical ergot. It also produced quite profound changes in the brain. And he understood that this was a radical discovery, because up to that point, no substance had been discovered which could actually change the way your brain works, rather than just dampen down feelings or, you know, deal with pain or sleep or something. And he said, you know, this is my wonder child. You know, this will open up a whole new avenue of research and also therapeutic opportunities. And for the first 15 years after he discovered it, there was a phenomenal amount of research. There were, I think, 40,000 patients were studied, over 1,000 research papers, looking at the utility of this drug in a range of different disorders, particularly psychiatric disorders, and often in addiction. There were 6 studies done using LSD to help people overcome alcoholism, trying to break the habit of alcoholism.
How would that have worked? What's the LSD doing to the brain to help you break an addiction?
Well, what happens in an addiction is your brain gets locked into a mindset that you have to take the drug, and in fact, the mindset is so habitual that often people drink even though they don't want to drink. They find themselves drinking, and how did I get here? Why am I doing this? I hate doing this, but they can't stop themselves. It's an ingrained habit, and that's because certain circuits in the brain get overlearned. And what LSD does is it sort of It disrupts those circuits for a period, certainly for a transient period, either long enough for people to see there's an alternative. Often people get insights under LSD. They actually accept that they're an alcoholic and therefore want to change. Up to that point, they might just be saying they're not. So it can change the way you see yourself. But I think there may be more fundamental changes, and that's one of our current research interests, is to use drugs like LSD or psilocybin to alter the way in which the brain gets locked into different mindsets, because I think it might actually change the ability of the brain, make it more able to be more flexible, and therefore make it easier for you to go into other alternative strategies of dealing with life rather than just rely on alcohol.
Let's talk a bit about the other so-called recreational drugs now, what they're doing to the brain. Yes. Now, ecstasy and amphetamines, tell us a bit about the chemicals they affect and the systems they affect.
So they're similar drugs. I'll just take you through the history. So in the 1800s, people discovered that a drug called ephedra, which actually is cathinone, actually the very similar to mefedrone, meow meow, comes from a plant, and that was the first real treatment we had for asthma, and it was so successful that the world supplies were not keeping up with the need of asthmatics, so companies started to look: is there a way we can make something like ephedra chemically? And they came up with amphetamine. So amphetamine was originally developed to treat asthma, and it does. I mean, when I started in medicine,
it still does today. If you're an asthmatic and you take amphetamines, you'll be fine.
No, yeah. I mean, in fact, when I started in medicine, I started on the wards in 1972. You know, there were people on the wards injecting themselves with methamphetamine. We now call it crystal meth to treat their asthma. It is a vasodilator. It does work. We don't use it now because we've got more sophisticated. We actually spray analog compounds into the lungs rather than take them systemically. But we still do have systemic treatments for asthma based on that kind of molecule. So that's where amphetamine came from. And what it does is it releases, in the case of treating asthma, it releases noradrenaline to dilate the lungs, the bronchi in the lungs. But it also releases dopamine in the brain. And that's why amphetamine makes people awake, alert, active, because dopamine is the drive transmitter. It gets you up and gets you going. Now, MDMA is a derivative of amphetamine, MDMA ecstasy is. And it was designed to be a better kind of amphetamine, particularly in relation to mood benefits. And the reason it's better is because it has more effect on serotonin. So MDMA releases dopamine and makes you more active, and you can dance for long periods, but it also releases serotonin, and that's what gives you empathy, and that's why you feel better about people. And that's why MDMA, when it was first discovered, and it was used, started off being developed as a potential treatment for depression, but it got very markedly, heavily used as an adjunct in psychotherapy, because people could actually engage in therapy under the influence of the drug, because it dampened down either the anger that they had with their partner or their family or their parents, or actually it dampened down the fear that they might have if they're talking about stressful things that have happened to them. So it was a very interesting drug. And until kids started using it, it was really, you know, moving the field of psychotherapy forward. Then it started being used, then it got banned, and then all research stopped. And it's only just been resurrected. Now, there was one very important study published a couple of years ago where it's been shown that MDMA, as an adjunct to cutting-edge psychotherapy for severe traumatic disorder, PTSD, is very helpful in actually getting people into a much better place. So we are now ourselves trying to get funding to do a study in veterans, Afghan veterans, because many of them have enduring traumatic memories, which current treatments don't deal with.
So would it be that you would take MDMA during psychotherapy to allow you to remember what's happened and deal with it? I
mean, yes, let me explain. We know that we've all been traumatized. We've all had horrible things happen to us, not as bad as, you know, many people have, but everyone's had a bad memory, bad experience. And the way the brain deals with that is to repress it. You actually hold down the memory. So you just stop it coming into consciousness. But if I was to say to you, and we do this in our research, I want you to think of a really bad thing that happened to you. You can bring that back and you can have that experience. Now, what happens in PTSD is that someone, for instance, has been blown up by a mine in Afghanistan and seen their partners, you know, fragmented. And that image is with them all the time. You know, it'll never go. You'll never get rid of that memory. But what you do is you suppress it. But in some people, either because they're so stressed or the memories are so traumatic or that there's other stresses in their lives, they cannot suppress the memory. And the memory keeps coming into consciousness. And you can't live a life if you're continually seeing these images rolling through your mind of your buddies being blown to pieces. So the way we deal with PTSD is people have to get the image or the memory, and then they have to overwrite it. They have to come to terms with it, either dampen down the emotions or as I say, hopefully overwrite it.
But to do that, you have to have it there in front of you.
You have to have it there. And for severe PTSD, people cannot sustain it. If the memory comes up, they do what we call dissociate. They have a panic attack, or they just completely lose contact, you know, they sort of blank out. So you can't do the psychotherapy to get rid of the problem. So now under MDMA, the emotional content of the memory is dampened down. So you can deal with the memory better. Therefore, you can engage in the therapy and then overcome the trauma.
It's probably worth mentioning some other drugs which are legal that people maybe forget are drugs. Things like alcohol, caffeine and tobacco. These things have just as strong an effect on the brain as some of the things we've been talking about. Take us through those and then we can compare the sort of reasons why one's illegal and one isn't.
Sure. Yeah, so it is really important to understand that alcohol is a drug. And there's been an enormous industry called the alcohol industry trying to persuade you it's not. It's a foodstuff. But of course, it's a drug. It's a drug which works in the brain. It works largely through mimicking the natural calming transmitter in the brain called GABA. So alcohol dampens down the brain. And that's why alcohol will put you to sleep if you drink a lot. And that's why it kills you if you drink as much as Amy Winehouse drank. But alcohol is a rather sophisticated drug because it, as well as dampening down the brain, it also turns on some of the dopamine cells in the brain. And that's why you can be energized as well as relaxed with alcohol. So it's a bit like the old days. In the 1950s, there was a lot of use of a drug called Purple Hearts. Purple Hearts was a mixture of a downer, barbiturates, and an upper amphetamine. And alcohol has that in its own molecule. It works a bit like a Purple Heart. It's a downer and an upper. And that's why it's a particularly addictive drug. Tobacco is different. Tobacco produces, when you smoke it, you produce nicotine. And that's why nicotine patches or nicotine gums are good strategies for stopping smoking. But smoking is a bit more subtle than that, because when you smoke, you also produce substances which get into the brain and block an enzyme called monoamine oxidase. And monoamine oxidase is the enzyme that breaks down dopamine. So when we smoke one of about 20 a day, you've blocked that enzyme completely. And that contributes to the sort of mood benefits of smoking. But it also contributes to the difficulty in stopping. Because what you find then is when you've relied on having this enzyme blocked, and when you stop smoking, the enzyme unblocks and it's actually upregulated, it's more active. So that then chews up your dopamine a bit too fast. And so people go into this terrible depression, irritability when they stop smoking.
Now, you've outlined many different effects of many different chemicals that people take for many different reasons. How on earth do you start to scientifically measure the harms or the benefits from all of these things? Because pharmaceuticals, take for example, the stuff that's you take for your headache, or people are taking for anesthesia, or anything else, things are regulated. These are doing harm to you, but they're also beneficial to you, and there's a scientific reason for taking them. It seems like these sorts of recreational, let's call them drugs, are in a sort of world of their own, though, when it comes to harms. We don't seem to regulate them in the same way. How can you understand the difference, whether alcohol is more harmful than cannabis, or whether caffeine is less harmful than opioids?
Well, that's a really interesting, important, but very complex question. So the simple analysis is, can you compare benefits and harms? And that's quite difficult with recreational drugs, because how do you quantify benefit of having a good time at a
pleasure,
party?
Pleasure, I guess.
Yeah, but, well, we can do it. We can. We can look at the pleasurable effects of drugs. We can score those. And you know, and that often relates to how likely people are to become dependent on them. But not necessarily. I mean, a lot of people are dependent on nicotine, even though it's not intrinsically pleasurable to start with. It's because actually they're protecting themselves against withdrawal. So getting good estimates of pleasure is very difficult. And mostly when we do analyses of drug harms, we actually don't look at the benefits, because many people would say there are no benefits of an illegal drug. I mean, that's wrong, because obviously people wouldn't take them if they didn't get benefits. But looking at the benefits is something that we haven't really got a handle on. But what we are good at is looking at the harms. And the harms come in various forms, and you can roughly divide them into two sets of harms: the harms to the person who takes them and the harms to society. So the harms to the individual using, say, a drug like alcohol, is that if they take a lot, like Amy Winehouse did, you might just die. And about 3 young people a week just die just of alcohol poisoning. They just drink more than they should, and they just drop dead. And then there are harms from chronic use of the drug. So a drug like nicotine or tobacco will damage your lungs, and so might cannabis to some extent. And then there are harms from how you use the drug. So and this is one of the big problems with the whole legal-illegal debate, because much of the harms from illegal drugs like heroin are driven by the fact that they're illegal. So people don't have clean drug, so they might be injecting themselves with bacteria like Clostridium or anthrax, which happens regularly, or they get infected by other people's viruses when they share needles. So that's a separate element of harm. The criminality aggravates the harms. But the harms to the individual can be balanced on one side, and then there's the harms to society, and these are harms. So in the case of alcohol, most domestic violence is fueled by alcohol. A lot of street violence is fueled by alcohol. Where traffic accidents, alcohol is very high on those, nicotine very low, which is why alcohol scores higher usually in most measures of harm than nicotine. Cannabis somewhere in between. It might aggravate accidents, but not as much as alcohol. So we can score those harms. And then we can also score other more nebulous harms, like international harms. You know, I mean, clearly the international impact of the cocaine trade in South America is enormous, particularly for South America, particularly for Mexico at present. Whereas, you know, the alcohol industry has very little impact on international harm. So what we've done is we've actually got a 17-point scale, 9 points, 9 factors of the individual, 7 factors to society, and then we rank every drug on those 16 points.
Some of these things are subjective, though, to some extent.
Now, yeah, it's very important, and this technique is called multi-criteria decision analysis, and it is designed to deal with the fact, or to deal with situations where you do not have all the facts, where you can never have all the facts. So it's a way of making the best judgments based on knowledge, expertise and evidence. And it allows you to amalgamate evidence and expertise in a fashion so that you can, in the end, come up with a single metric.
And so when you did this, when you published this 17-point scale, just explain who makes the decisions. I mean, you're a scientist. Do you have police involved? Do you have other people who also then tell you the harms to society? Because that's, again, very hard to quantify.
So it's a 16-point scale, 9 harms to the individual, 7 harms to society. Those 16 different dimensions, parameters of harm, that was developed by the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, this broad committee. When I was chairing that in the Home Office, we had a special meeting, you know, we had a special conference in order to work out what were the harms of drugs, both to individuals, the scientists, and to society, the police, the school teachers, the judges, etc. And that's, so it was a real bottom-up approach. We looked at every conceivable harm and discovered you could then parcelate them into these 16 different variables. So that's the first start. And the second stage then is you have to evaluate these harms using expert groups. And that the paper that we're referring to, the Lancet paper in 2010, that was done by the Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs. Now, that was a group of experts, which again ranges from social scientists right through to forensic scientists. And they then do two things. They rank the drugs according to their relative harms on each of those dimensions. And then, and this is the really key thing, they weight the different dimensions. And we decided, our committee decided, that the greatest weight we would give to economic costs, because that we thought was actually where drug harms are most felt. So we said economic damage is the most important. And everything else we scaled to that. Now, one of the powers of this technology is a different group of people might come up with a very different set of weightings. Some people might say, well, we don't care about the economics. We care about what's happening in South America. So we're going to score the international harm much, much higher than the economic harm to the UK. And other people might say, well, we actually don't care about social things. We just care about the individual. So this technology is one that you can export to different interest groups. And yesterday I was talking to the Select Committee, the Home Affairs Select Committee, and I've offered to do it with parliamentarians because it was clear from talking to them that some people do struggle with weightings. And it'd be fascinating to know whether politicians actually came up with a completely different set of weightings and therefore a different scale of drug relative drug harms than the scientists.
Well, that system itself is a very sort of, as you say, bottom-up approach, which you could use to rank one thing against another. Yeah. And doing that with your weightings, you came out with alcohol. Yes. As possibly the most harmful drug. Now, just explain that a little bit for people. I mean, that might be surprising to people who...
I'll tell you, we were surprised. Because we used a less sophisticated system 3 years before, and alcohol came out fifth. So then we used these multi-criteria, these 16 points. And I was amazed. As the figures...
Did you not suspect, given all these harms?
Not at all. No, I hadn't... It's a very complicated process, as you can imagine. 20 drugs, 16 variables, all ranked. There's no way anyone can influence the outcome. And then suddenly, when you put it through the computer and you churn through, suddenly alcohol came out. And we thought, how can this be? You know, we were surprised. And then we looked at it. And if you look at the graph, the big weightings for alcohol are the harms to society. And when you look at that, there's huge economic cost. I mean, alcohol costs this country $30 billion a year. Every taxpayer is paying £1,000 a year excess tax to support drinking. It causes, it's a $3 billion cost to the NHS. It's a $6 billion cost in terms of policing and social disorder. And those are the factors that really make alcohol the most harmful drug because these huge social costs.
How much of that is due to the fact that it is legal and most people take it?
Now, that's a really interesting question. And, of course, it is legal and most people do take it. I mean, I don't know if you've seen these most recent data came out last week. Half of all 15 to 16-year-olds binge drink once a month. So they're 3 years under the legal drinking age, and half of them are drunk every month. And 85% of all 15 to 16-year-olds drink. And that tells you how available it is. And that, of course, if it's that pervasive, even in young people, then of course it's going to have a huge social impact. And that's one of the point about this. It's not simply that that's the explanation of why alcohol is so harmful, but that tells us what we should be doing because we should be doing things to reduce the harms of alcohol. And we know what to do because we know why alcohol is so prevalent and why drinking levels have risen so much in the last 30, 40 years. And that's because we've made it much more available in supermarkets and we've reduced the price by 50% effectively.
Well, hopefully that'll be somehow dealt with a minimum pricing for the units. I mean, is that something that is a good policy for a change when it comes to drugs?
Yeah, actually, that's the first bit of common sense we've seen in relation to alcohol policy in a very long time. Unquestionably, minimum pricing will reduce the harms to very heavy drinkers and young drinkers disproportionately to the actual price rise. I mean, we know that those two populations are very sensitive to price changes.
Now, we mentioned that a lot of the severity of the alcohol problem is because of the availability. If, for example, I don't know, cannabis was legal and it was used by everyone on a Friday night in the same way that alcohol was, would you still see massive harms from those? I mean, that would allow you to then compare those two drugs.
That's a really fundamental scientific question. Yeah, on a level playing field, without all these bizarre and complex distortions through legality and illegality, which would be the more harmful drugs, or which would be the most harmful drug? And there are two ways of you approach this. I mean, one way is, you know, your best estimate, knowing what the harms are and knowing how addictive the drugs are, etc. And I've done that. I've done it in a recent paper where I called popular intoxicants. I've compared alcohol and cannabis. And my best guess is if both were available in a similar fashion, i.e. in a bar or a coffee shop, my view is that cannabis would probably be only about between about a quarter and a half as harmful as alcohol on a level playing field. The other way you approach it is you look to see whether there are societies in which they are equally available. Now, there's no place in the world where they're both legal and marketed. But there are countries in which they're both illegal and not marketed. And the best data comes from Morocco, because Morocco is a center for the World Health Organization analysis of psychiatric problems. And there in Morocco, where both drugs are illegal, it turns out that it's about, I think about 2.7% of the Moroccan population is alcohol dependent. And about, I think it's about 1.9 or so of the population is cannabis dependent.
That's surprising.
And especially as they grow so much cannabis there. That's right. So that gives you a sense that in population terms, you know, alcohol is more of an addictive drug than cannabis. Yeah.
So let's go back to a few years ago when you were the chair of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. This is the independent, or so-called independent body that's meant to advise the Home Office on drugs policy and, you know, advise on the classification of drugs. Everything was going swimmingly. Until you gave a lecture about ecstasy and horse riding, and subsequently you were sacked. Yes. Just take us through what happened.
So I worked for the Advisory Council for, up to that point, for 9 years. I chaired the scientific committee that looked at drugs, looked at the harms of drugs, looked at new drugs coming along. You know, what should we, how can we rate drugs? And I brought in the beginnings of this systematic way of analysing drugs and thinking about drug harms. And while we were chugging along over those years, you know, drugs like BZP were made illegal and ketamine was made illegal. And these all made sense in the context of the way we thought about drugs. But it seemed to me there was a bigger issue, and that was the issue of what should the threshold be? What are the real comparators of harm? You know, if we say we're going to stop kids taking ecstasy because it's harmful, we should at least have a proper measure of relative harms in comparison to what other things kids do. Otherwise, it's arbitrary. Because if we're going to just use this harm reduction approach to ecstasy, you know, rather than use it to say to bungee jumping or rock climbing, then you know that at least it's in a sense arbitrary. You know, these are people make choices to do those things. So if we really are banning drugs because of harms, we also must have measures of relative harm. And the question is, what are the best measures? And I got an insight one day in my clinic. So I'm a doctor, I'm a clinician, I'm a psychiatrist. One of my specialities is treating people who've got brain damage, usually from tumours. But one day I saw a woman in her 30s who'd had severe frontal brain damage from falling off a horse. And it had completely changed her personality. Often that happens when you damage the front of your brain. And her husband had left her, she'd taken the children away, and she'd lost her job. And she was in a very difficult state because she was so impulsive. She couldn't control her behaviour. And I treated her with amphetamine, an illegal drug, which actually is good at helping people control impulsivity. And it helped her a bit, but it was never going to cure her because she'd actually lost a large chunk of her brain. But it got me thinking, you know, how dangerous is horse riding? And of course, you know, Christopher Reeve, you know, Superman died from his broken back from horse riding. And I did some research and I realised horse riding was actually much, much more dangerous than I'd ever imagined. And I was rather shaken by that because my two daughters, I'd encouraged to go horse riding. And it's one of those sort of dirty secrets. People don't talk about the dangers of horse riding because people don't want to know the truth there. And then I thought, well, horse riding is interesting. And, you know, not only is it dangerous, people love doing it, but actually some people kind of get addicted to it. And some people can't. And in fact, you talk to people that do a lot of riding and it is necessary. If they stop riding, they go into withdrawal. So I thought, well, this will be quite an interesting comparison. And I did a relatively scientific comparison, deaths, harms from the two. And I discovered that horse riding was at least as dangerous as ecstasy.
In terms of the number of deaths a year?
In terms of deaths, in terms of number of... Yeah, I mean, a horse rider, you know, people die, they break their spine, they break their back, they break their pelvis, but also, they also kill other people. There are about 100 major road accidents a year where people die because horses run into them and they crash into horses, etc. So, it's, you know, horse riding doesn't just kill a horse and kill a rider, it also can kill innocent bystanders. So when you balance it, certainly, if you wanted to, say, reduce harms, you'd ban horse riding rather than ecstasy.
I can see what you're doing there, because you characterised horse riding in a way as a sort of drug with the addictions and the harms. But if you're going to start comparing drugs to social activities, I mean, what about driving cars or people who die because of, you know, something hits them on the pavement or cycling, for example?
These are really important questions. So let me. Just to finish, I mean, I thought the way to get people's attention was to invent a drug called Equacy, equine addiction syndrome. So that's the paper was comparing ecstasy with Equacy. It was extraordinarily successful, over 7,000 downloads of that paper. Some of my friends are very angry because they started reading it thinking there was a drug they didn't know about, and then they got to the second page and discovered it was a parable about horse riding. So I'm thinking about another paper. I'm thinking about speeding. Now, speeding is a very interesting concept because it means two different things. I mean, to you, it means driving a car fast. But to some people, it means taking speed, amphetamine. And that's another interesting comparison. Which is more dangerous? Well, the reality is, speeding as you drive is much more dangerous to society than people taking amphetamine. And I think we have to make these comparisons. And a guy called David Spiegelhalter in Cambridge has got a very interesting way of making these comparisons. He's a professor of public understanding of risk at Cambridge University. And he's developed this concept called the micromort. Now, a micromort is a 1 in 1 million chance of dying. So when you go out on your cycle in London, every 17 miles, you've got a 1 in 1 million chance of dying. If you drive a motorbike, it's every 1 in 9 miles. So that's a way you can scale the risks of different activities.
You can give them a micromort value.
Exactly. And then an ecstasy tablet, I think, is about half a micromort. So you've got to take two ecstasy tablets to have a 1 in 1 million chance of dying. So an ecstasy tablet is like as risky as driving 17 miles on a pushbike. And this is a really powerful way of comparing harms. And I've tried to persuade him to work on alcohol. He's done it for tobacco. And you can, I've forgotten what the output is. It may be in the book. But I think, like, you know, every cigarette's like a micromort or something. So, but I'd like him to do it for alcohol because it's so difficult with alcohol because it influences behavior in society in so many ways.
So going back to your Equacy paper, you were giving a lecture about this and it was picked up by the media. And that's when the Home Office noticed. And yes. Alan Johnson, the then Health Secretary, sent you an email.
So let me get you clear on this one. So no, when the Equacy paper was Jackie Smith. Jackie Smith got very irate, and we had this interesting discussion where she said, "You shouldn't have done this because what your job is to tell me about the harms of drugs, not the harms of horse riding." And I said, "Well, yeah, but you know, if we are going to make a decision about this, where we put ecstasy in the classification system, we have to know what its relative harms are, and society needs to know, because there's been, for the last 30 years, there's been a media attack on ecstasy, trying to portray it as being much more dangerous than it is. And that's why it's a Class A drug. I mean, you know, when we did the review of ecstasy, it was no way it was a Class A drug. You know, it was a Class B or maybe Class C. But the media are determined it should be a Class A drug for reasons, I think, largely because of the name. I think journalists don't like the idea that kids have ecstasy, you know, because they can hardly remember when they used to have ecstasy themselves, you know, in the other forms of ecstasy, you know what I mean? And I think that's the problem, that the name of the drug is actually distorted. And I thought it's time to bring we've got to get this debate anchored in reality. We can't let media and prejudice. But she couldn't understand that. She said it's not possible to compare an illegal activity with a legal one. And I said, well, suppose we have a new drug. Suppose, I didn't know about methadone at the time, but suppose methadone was coming along. How are you going to decide whether to ban that or not, unless you know how harmful it is? Or are you just going to ban all drugs simply because you want to stop people taking things that they might like? And that's why it's an important important to have that threshold. And I would say if something's less harmful than horse riding, then why would you ban it?
But so when you came out with this paper and the subsequent machinations meant that you did get sacked, what were the conversations you had with Alan Johnson? He's the one who eventually did sack you.
Yes.
What were the conversations you had with him around the sort of a sensible drugs policy?
Well, it was interesting, that the sacking, because I think 3 days before he sacked me, we'd had a meeting and we discussed all the complexities about new legal highs, about methadone, about spice, about GBL. You know, we'd had a very rational, sensible discussion. I thought we were on the same wavelength. And then, 3 days later, a few broadcasts about my opinion that cannabis was more harmful than alcohol and the ecstasy was less harmful than horse riding. Everything completely switched. The media got very angry with me, and then he was forced to act. He felt he had to do something to make sure that the public weren't made aware that the drug policy was a complete mess.
The media, you mean the right-wing press is what you mean?
The reality is that politicians and civil servants are terrified of two newspapers, The Mail and The Sun. And all policy decisions are couched so as not to offend those.
Since that period, you haven't been idle when it comes to making your views known on drugs policy. You set up the Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs, and that is meant to be a sort of independent place for these sorts of harm analyses that you talk about. Tell us a bit about the work that that's doing, and how has it been received?
So the Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs, which we set up, and it actually has quite a few of the scientists from the old ACMD. They moved across.
A lot of them resigned with you, didn't they?
They did.
When you were sacked, rather.
They were very, very angry about it. So we had the core of expertise across the range of veterinary medicine to forensic science. And then we've expanded it to about 20, 25 people. And we have a range going now from social scientists and right through again to forensic science, school teachers and educationists, etc. It's the only truly independent group in the world because we don't get any funding from government. And also we're not aligned to any of the lobby groups. So there's a lot of information in the web from people who are pro-drug, and there's a lot from people who are anti-drug. And we're neutral. We just say that all drugs are potentially harmful and people should know the truth about drugs. And our website, I think, is the place journalists go. Most journalists, many scientists even come to us to ask us about drugs and the drug laws, etc. So we're fulfilling, I think, a really critical role in terms of analysis of information and disseminating information and supporting rational discussion and research on drugs.
So when Alan Johnson, special advisor, who I believe was in the process when he was one of the people who helped to sack you, he said on Twitter after your evidence to the House of Commons Select Committee last week, he said no responsible government would have David Nutt as a drugs advisor. That doesn't bother you anymore?
Well, I would say that really exemplifies the problem, that if government doesn't want to know the truth, then I suppose you choose advisors that don't tell you the truth. But that is in the end destructive. It's destructive to policy making, and it's destructive to lives. Drugs kill people, and bad drug policies, which is what we have at present, kill a lot more people than good drug policies. So it's about time that politicians wisened up. And it's not, drugs is not about getting re-elected. We need a bit more courage. We need politicians to know the truth about drugs. And in fact, we know they do. I mean, the Home Affairs Select Committee 10 years ago also looked at drugs. David Cameron was on that committee. And in the report, point 24, he said, the international drug conventions have failed. It is time to relook at them and also to consider regulation or even legalization in order to improve the situation. And 10 years on, we've actually done nothing to improve the situation in the UK. In fact, under Gordon Brown and Jackie Smith, when we were criminalizing hundreds of thousands of young people for cannabis possession, we actually went backwards a long way.
Do you think there will ever be a sensible political debate around drugs? People, when they leave office, often say, I wish I could have said this when I was in office, that actually the drug war is pointless. We're criminalizing lots of young people. It's doing more harm than good, and we're wasting lots of money. They say that sort of stuff. And it's like a recurring nightmare for people like you, I'm sure, who've said this stuff to them whilst in government, but they don't listen. Do you think there will ever be that willingness or the bravery that you talk about?
Yeah, I think so. I think the fact that we are having this discussion here today, the fact that the discussion about drugs, and hopefully my book will help that, is much more in the public domain. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have gone on to a program like this and said as explicitly as I've said what I've said today, because no one had done it before. Now I've done it. Others can do it. I think people can be actually. There's a much more open debate about drugs, and I think the myth that alcohol isn't a drug, and the sort of inviolable status of alcohol as our favourite drug, that's also being challenged because of the huge economic burden. So no, I think we're in a much better situation. Most of the country know that what I'm saying is right. A large majority of them would actually like the law to be changed in accordance with the evidence. And it's just politicians, the next generation of politicians, I'm sure, will change. We know that many of the younger group of politicians, and that includes the Tory front bench, they've used drugs. They use drugs at school, they've used drugs, and these are legal drugs I'm talking about. They've used them at school, they've used them at university. I mean, maybe some of them are still using them now, I don't know. But they know that you cannot continue to pursue these lies and these half-truths about drugs. And I think eventually that will have to force a much more reasonable approach.
Now, what are the effects of this ban on certain drugs, things like ecstasy, MDMA and opioids and all sorts of things, is that you can't actually do research, or you can't very easily do research on them to work out what benefits they might have or, in fact, what the overall harms might be. So you ban them because of media pressure or whatever else, political pressure, but you don't do it with much evidence. Now, we've outlined some of those, but you talked recently about the kinds of scientific research that we're missing out on. So take us through some examples.
So the reality is this. Drugs which get made illegal, such as LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, that are made illegal before they have been registered as medicines, get put into a thing called Schedule 1, which means it's virtually impossible for scientists to work with them. And worse, if you do work with them, and you find they may have some therapeutic utility, doctors can't prescribe them. So let me give you a couple of examples. I've already talked about the stress and PTSD and the use of MDMA as a possible therapy. Now, we're teeing up to try to do the first UK study of MDMA psychotherapy for PTSD. Because the drug's illegal, that study is going to cost considerably more than it would have if the drug was not Schedule 1. And if it works, which I hope it will, no doctor will be able to prescribe it. Because in order to do that, they'd have to get their own special license and they'd have to comply with a whole range of regulations, which would make it impossible for them to actually use the drug.
So why do the research?
Well, because we have to go. I do the research because we need to know if it works. And we need to get the law changed. So I'm hoping that if we campaign enough now...
Catalyst.
Well, yes, whilst the research is going on, let's change the law so that if the research is positive, then people can use the drug. So we're starting a study of psilocybin in depression based on our brain imaging studies of psilocybin and hopefully doing this MDMA study in PTSD. But there's a bigger issue in relation to science. Drugs like psilocybin, LSD, MDMA, they produce fundamental changes in the way the brain works. And they produce changes in the most interesting bits of the brain, the bits of the brain which deal with consciousness and feelings. And the fact that no one has studied these in the last 40 years, using the enormously improved technology of neuroscience, is an outrage. I think it's one of the... I can't think of another example of a scandal, of a failure to pursue quality science. Because all the research we do on consciousness is really scrabbling at the feet of the mountain. You know, if you really want to understand how the brain generates consciousness, you need to use drugs like LSD and psilocybin, which perturb it. If you want to understand emotion, you need to use drugs like MDMA, which produce fundamental changes in emotion. So we've wasted 40 years of opportunity. And I just find that outrageous and actually rather sad. And so I really want to campaign now to allow scientists, neuroscientists, to maximize the utility of these drugs to understand the brain.
But why can't they use them right now? I mean, surely scientists at accredited universities or in hospitals can get licenses to use these things, even if they don't necessarily want to produce a usable drug out of it. To understand the brain, for example, it sounds like a sensible thing to do.
The reality is this. The reality is that, yes, you can. If you are prepared, and there aren't many people like me who are prepared to spend a year going through, jumping through all the hoops to get permissions, to get all the special kit, to get all the licenses, to go through the police checks, etc., to be able to store the drug and do the science. Most people cannot be bothered. That's too hard. But beyond that, there are two or three other factors. The first is that funding bodies don't want to fund research on illegal drugs because it puts them in a bad light. Scientists are quite scared. I have talked to senior scientists and said, look, they said, this is a great experiment, Dave. It's just too politically sensitive. We can't go with you. You know, you've got to go alone. We don't want to be contaminated with working with illegal drugs. When we published, presented to the public on the BBC Three programme with Michael Mosley, after the first ever study of psilocybin on brain function that had been done using modern techniques, an MP, Jim Dobbin, said in Parliament, under parliamentary privilege, why was Professor Nutt allowed to do a scientific study on an illegal drug? And that really sums up the kind of pressures. When MPs are criticising you in Parliament for doing science, you can see why people are scared to do it and why funding bodies don't want to touch it. So almost my psilocybin work has not been funded. It's all been done by me and my team for free. We've raised the money. You know, it's bootstrapped. We actually did get a bit of money then from the Beckley Foundation to support it. But no major funder has gone with it. The good news is that since we did that study and we showed that psilocybin switches off the part of the brain, the anterior cingulate cortex, which is overactive in depression, we've used that finding to convince the Medical Research Council, the MRC, to fund us to do a study in depression. So now, you know, I think we're beginning to open the doors to a more rational approach. But I suspect that'll be the first study the MRC's funded using in this sort of area.
So given the optimism you have with politicians and the avenues of research there are, do you think that in, I don't know, 10, 20 years, that this is going to be a field of active research?
Well, it must be. Otherwise, the scientists are actually not living up to the requirements of their discipline. If you really want to understand the brain, you have to use drugs which change the brain function. And if you're not working with these kind of drugs, then you really are not doing the best science.
Just finally, at the end of your book, you talk about advice for parents, the things that parents can tell their children about drugs. What would you tell your children about drugs? What have you told your children about drugs?
It's all in the book. So I've talked to them from an early age. Children need to talk about drugs from a very early age. They need to know what parents are, you know, what this stuff is parents are drinking. You have to remember that 10% of the UK population has a drink problem. Many children are brought up in households where alcoholism is present in both parents. From 3 or 4, these children are suffering the consequences either of neglect or violence from these drunk parents. A smaller proportion have been brought up in households where the parents are stoned on cannabis or they're under the influence of crack or heroin. And again, that causes problems. So children need to know what's going on. So at the very least, when they go to school, they can talk to their teachers about the problems at home. So we've got to start educating children about drugs as soon as they can understand the concept of inebriation and intoxication. And then we have to tell them the truth. We have to tell them the truth about the harms of drugs, the addictiveness of drugs, but we also have to tell them the truth about the harms of criminalization. So if you choose, I don't think you can direct children to choose a drug like alcohol if they prefer to use something like ecstasy or cannabis, but they just need to be aware that if they choose to use a drug which is currently illegal, they do run the risks of getting a criminal record, and that criminal record will potentially have a major impact on their lives. I think that's one of the reasons why we're getting this increase in alcohol use, because people have decided that they prefer to take the more harmful drug, alcohol, than the less harmful drug, cannabis, because the criminal, any kind of criminal record from cannabis would actually be much more deleterious in the short term than the long-term damage they're doing to themselves with alcohol.
So you would advise them to educate themselves as much as possible, as soon as possible.
Yes.
I mean, but then what do you do about the harms of them afterwards?
Well, you do things to minimise harms, and there are lots of things you can do to minimise harms. Obviously, the best way is not to take any drug. You know, then you can never come to harm.
Do you worry that people sometimes might interpret your liberal nature to all of these things as an encouragement?
Well, I think some people do interpret that. I'm not liberal, I'm rational. And I'm not encouraging people to take drugs. If you want to, I mean, all drugs are harmful. And I think if you're going to use drugs, you should do it knowing what you're doing. I mean, there are some guidance I would give. I mean, for instance, if you're drunk, don't go out looking for drugs because your judgment would be impaired. If you're using alcohol, don't use another sedative like an opiate or GHB or GBL because they're very additive or even you get summative, you know, multiplicative effects. So there are certain things that people should know about all drugs. But then if you make a decision to use a stimulant rather than alcohol, well, that's your choice. But be aware, of course, that you don't know what you're buying. I mean, this is one of the other really disturbing features of the current situation. The illegality of drugs means that people don't know what they're taking, and they may be taking something which they don't want to take and which may be more harmful than what we're predicting. And the two deaths last year at Alexandra Palace where kids thought they were taking crystal ecstasy, they were taking a substance which is 10 times more potent, PMMA. If they knew it was PMMA, they either wouldn't have taken it or they would have maybe taken a lot less. And that's where the Dutch have this testing system, and it's a very sensible harm reduction method. If you've got a substance, you can go to one of these, I think they have about 12 laboratories throughout the Netherlands. You can hand it in, they'll test it. There's no police involvement. There's no chance of you getting any prosecutions. And they will tell you what the drug is, and they'll tell you what the harms are, and they'll say, okay, it's your call. But more than that, the Dutch know what their kids are taking. We don't. So the Dutch can actually instigate policies of education and harm reduction and health that we can't. I think this is a brilliant system. And when I was, one of the other things, I fell out with the government. When I was chair of the ACMD, I said to Jackie Smith, I said, could we please have the Dutch expert come across and give us a seminar on what they do and, you know, what the evidence is of its being useful? She said, no. Don't want to know evidence. You know, we're just going to pursue this rhetoric-based drug policy.
Well, what drives you to do this? Because you're a neuroscientist, you could just stop there and treat patients. Yeah. But all of this makes you politically very unpopular. What keeps you moving through it and, in fact, writing books and continuing to agitate?
Well, I feel quite passionately, hopefully it comes across that like that. You know, the way we deal with drugs is one of the great mistakes in the last century. It's the whole concept of prohibition, the war on drugs, the irrational polemic about drugs, I think has done a huge disservice to society. And it's an area that I went into medicine to do research on the brain, and I realized from a very early time that I was interested in how drugs change the brain. Well, you know, I think I was about 13 when my father said, you should read this. This was Hoffman's description of how he accidentally discovered LSD. He accidentally pipetted it into his mouth. And then he wrote this description of what it was like cycling home and how it seemed to take 5 hours. And I read that and I thought, well, this has got to be very important. If a drug can change time perception like that, you know, that must be telling us something fundamental about the nature of time perception. We should study these drugs, if the very least, to work out how the brain tells time. I just thought, you know, there's a revelation. And of course, you know, it was. It's just the one we've never really been able to develop because of the hysteria about young people using it.
David, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Professor David Nutt's book, Drugs Without the Hot Air, is published by UIT Cambridge. And all the proceeds from the sales will go to the Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.